When I arrived at the reception desk to be told I was no longer wanted, I have to admit I was selfish. I firmly believe that we helped to change the face of British broadcasting.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Keith Skews.
I was born in a small village called Timperley. That was just before the outbreak of World War II in 1939. I was one of three children born to Richard and Doris Eileen Skews. I had a younger sister, Margaret, brother Christopher. Sadly, my brother only lived for a few months. My sister was killed in a car crash on her 21st birthday. She'd been a passenger in a friend's car and was hit by an oncoming car that was on the wrong side of the road. My parents were very strict, actually. They weren't impressed with my liking for rock and roll pop music of the mid-1950s. They actually ordered me out of the house to set up all my own radio bits and pieces in a shed that was located at the bottom of the garden. I attended a local grammar school in Altrincham in Cheshire and often had with me my crystal set. I used to sit at the back of the class where I could attach a piece of wire to the water pipes to act as an earth. Crystal sets didn't require batteries. I used to listen on headphones, got caught numerous times and duly caned for not paying attention to the teacher. One person who was quite understanding was my Latin master, who was also a radio amateur, G3AKX, if my memory serves me correctly, Golf 3 Alpha Kilo X-ray. He taught me how to build not just a crystal set, but a superhet radio receiver that would pick up the amateur wave bands that I used to listen to in the shed that was surrounded by very tall trees, so were ideal for erecting an aerial. I used to listen to amateurs from all over the world, but as a teenager, I really did like the pop music of the day. That was rock and roll. My parents hated this. They called it hooligan music. So my hours in the shed began to take the norm. Radio Luxembourg, that faded in, and it faded out on 208 metres in the medium wave.
And there for Lily Turner in Hampshire, you heard Bill Haley's recording of Mambo Rock. Coming up to 16 minutes after 10 o'clock on tonight's Rockin' to Dreamland program. And if there's anything in particular you'd like to hear in the show, my friendly, do drop me a line. Radio Luxembourg, Hartford Street, London W1.
We didn't have much pop music on the BBC. One program that I really did enjoy from the BBC Light program was called Make Way for Music. That was broadcast from Manchester, featured the BBC Northern Dance Orchestra conducted by Alan Ainsworth, with radio announcer Roger Moffat.
And there you heard Ilklamore, an arrangement by Mr. Alan Roper. He's the gentleman who's made so much money out of the coffee business, he now has a house in his own grounds. Thank you, gentlemen. And now, for what we're about to receive, over to you, Mr. Ainsworth.
It prompted me to write a letter to the BBC and ask if I could sit in on one of their broadcasts. I received a polite reply from the programme secretary telling me that the show came from the studios in Piccadilly in Manchester, but it was a non-audience show. However, as I'd showed such great interest, I'd be invited to a broadcast in 1956. I duly turned up for the occasion and was met by a BBC commissionaire who asked, what did I want? I was actually still a schoolboy. I've come to see Make Way for Music, I said to him. You can't. We don't have an audience. I then showed him the letter from the programme secretary. He sort of mumbled and, how old are you? I told him. Anyway, he rang the secretary's phone extension and she came down to see me. Oh, I didn't realise you were so young, she said. I'd better go and see the producer. Cutting a long story sideways, I was allowed to see the show and even allowed to sit in the on-air studio for a short time. This was one of the most enjoyable days of my life up to that time. After the live broadcast on the BBC Light programme, I chatted with Alan Ainsworth, the conductor, and Roger Moffat, and They went off to a local pub. I returned home.
Well, how about that then? The end of what in polite society is referred to as make way for music. It's a live and lively broadcast from the Playhouse Theatre of Manchester.
At school, most of my chums wanted to be train drivers, but following that broadcast, I decided I wanted to be an announcer on the BBC. Roger Moffat presented classical music shows, he read the news, but on Make Way for Music, he was, he was slightly irreverent, to say the least. But he got away with it. Fast forward a year or so, and I was called up for national service and spent 2 years in the Royal Air Force.
Hello again, this is David Hamilton, continuing the story of the British number one.
I had realised that a number of well-known voices had entered the world of broadcasting through their time in uniform. Cliff Mitchell-Moore, Raymond Baxter, Don Moss, Keith Fordyce, Bill Crozier, David Jacobs, Desmond Carrington, David Hamilton, to name a few. So I dropped a line to the station director, Ian Wolfe. This is station director of the British Forces Network in Cologne. He replied saying that there would be an opportunity of a vacancy for someone in the Royal Air Force in a year's time, but that person would have to be stationed in Germany. Well, it took a lot of wrangling with the RAF bosses to have me posted to Germany. I was eventually posted to an underground radar station, so I contacted the station director at BFN and was invited down for an audition. This I failed and was politely told I did not have a broadcasting voice. However, they would take me on as a dog's body. Well, actually, this didn't bother me at all because I had my feet on the bottom rung of the ladder. During the following months, I learnt all about producing shows, how the record library worked, the administrative side of running a radio station, financial facts and figures, all very useful that would prove beneficial in my later life. Towards the end of my national service days, I was allowed on air to present a housewives request programme and also a late-night middle-of-the-road show. I still have letters to this day from listeners who dropped me a line at BFN, and half a dozen of them still tuned to my show on BBC Eastern Counties. How cool is that? Well, after my RAF service, I applied for a civilian commission with Forces Broadcasting Service that was administered by the then War Office in London. The interview went okay. I was offered a posting to Nairobi in East Africa. Not exactly round the corner, but a wonderful posting. And following on from the Mau Mau troubles, Kenya, I suppose I'm going to call it now, Kenya was settling back into a normal routine.
In Nairobi, capital of Kenya, Europeans and Africans still walk the streets in fear of the dreaded Mau Mau. For it is that band of...
The country itself is beautiful. It has everything from lakelands to mountain highlands and is the home to some wonderful wildlife with lions, elephants, rhinos, giraffes and so on and so forth. As well as broadcasting, I also joined an RAF team in 1962 to reach the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro, 19,340 feet. Management didn't actually like you promoting your own name. When I was presenting the Housewives programme in the morning, I used to say, "Monday morning, please don't snooze. It's hearty greetings from me, Keith Skews." And I was told to stop that because I was not a regular member of staff. You know, I was just there for a short period of time. So, anyway, I behaved myself for a while, but in the final week, I thought I'll try this Skewsy name-checking again. As I was in mid-flight, a group of very senior officers from the Army, Royal Navy, Royal Air Force appeared in the control room and could hear everything that I was saying, and they were accompanied by the station director. And so my announcement went, "Tuesday morning, please don't snooze, it's hearty greetings from, cardboard shoes." The first thing that came into my head, nothing more was said. And now about 2 days later, a listener in Holland sent in an actual pair of homemade cardboard shoes. I've still got them to this very day. And Bill Crozier, who used to present the German end of Two-Way Family Favourites on the BBC Light programme, said that my name from then on would be cardboard shoes, and it stuck with me right to this day. Amazingly, I receive as many letters addressed to cardboard shoes as I do to Keith Skews. 57 years since that name came into being. In 1963, I was selected to attend a BBC course in London on how to be a broadcaster. 3 months training, which proved very useful. However, at the end, I was due to return to Nairobi, but in my absence, the country had become independent and British military personnel were no longer required. My new job was in Aden, but there was unrest there in the Radfan. The new forces broadcasting station was attacked, and a lot of my personal archives, they allowed me to store them at the back of the concert hall. But unfortunately, those archives were destroyed by a bomb that hit the building. And I thought, I don't know. I decided to resign from Forces Broadcasting and made my way back to London.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When
I joined Radio Caroline in the summer of 1964 and spent 18 months having a most enjoyable time.
Downtown.
We were into the swinging 60s. Fashion and pop music was at its best. We had the Mary Quant phenomenon, Carnaby Street, John Stevens boutiques, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, top fashion model Jean the Shrimp Shrimpton, photographer David Bailey. Oh, we'd go on and on and on. There was Flower Power, Ready Steady Go's Kathy McGowan, top model Twiggy. We in Britain were going through the whole music explosion. We all seemed to have more money those days. National service was a thing of the past. Girls were on the pill, and it was good to be young. The 1960s was a very important time for young people. Music was an important part of their lives, and this is where the pirate radio stations came to the fore. Maybe parents of youngsters could not fully understand their offspring, and they didn't actually identify with teachers at school. But the watery wireless DJs had that special something that teenagers did identify with. From the freedom of international waters, I firmly believe that we helped to change the face and indeed the shape of British broadcasting. At a similar time, modern technology was gaining speed, and in the mid-1960s, we enjoyed the birth of the transistor radio, the tranny. And for the first time in our lives, radio became a portable medium. As DJs, we were doing our own thing and fighting against the forces of the establishment. But more importantly, we were providing a service which made music available day or night. There was the freedom of being yourself and having fun. There was no contact with land, no computers, no mobile phones. We were literally cut off from the rest of the world. We were on board for 14 days and 14 nights with no chance of coming ashore to pop down to a local pub or to go and see a film. We actually lived for correspondence from our listeners who wrote to us in their thousands. Never in my 57 years in radio have I ever experienced that sort of friendship with listeners, either before or after the days that I worked on the offshore stations. After our 2 week stint on board, we would return to London for a 1 week break.
Going back to Jane Morley's letter, just in answer to your question, Jane, what eyes have you got? I've got two of them. They are blue, normally black. They are blue at the moment. Hair is mousy, although I did have a look in the mirror today, and I got about five or six grey hairs.
Listeners would send us presents as well. Food parcels, cuddly toys, scarves, socks, gloves, woolly hats, even sweaters. The listeners were basically our lifeline. I mean, I remember on one occasion when I had a sore throat presenting the show, I said, I'm terribly sorry, I got a sore throat this morning. Loads of throat tablets arrived eventually about a week later. On the radio, we talked to our listeners rather than at them. The BBC at that time was somewhat upper crust with distinguished broadcasters speaking the Queen's English. as a former boss of the BBC, Lord Reith, had requested.
Hello and happy Easter to all of you. This is Christopher Moore with the First Record program on Radio Caroline. The First Record is by the Rolling Stones, and I'd like to play it for all of the people who worked to put the station on the air, and particularly for Ronan.
Radio Caroline was the first offshore radio station off the coast of the British Isles, and the station began thanks to Ronan O'Reilly, who came from Ireland to pursue a film career, but he enjoyed more working with music and promoting artists like the Rolling Stones and Georgie Fame. He had failed to get their records played on the BBC and likewise Radio Luxembourg, and the only way to topple their monopoly was to start his own radio station. The result was Caroline, and that would change the social and musical climate of Britain forever.
Yes, it's still top, the Beatles there, and Ticket to Ride. The time now is exactly 5 o'clock, Bulova Watch Time. B-U-L-O-V-A, Bulova, the world's largest makers of quality Swiss watches.
Have yourself a tank, tune into Caroline and cardboard shoes. Keith Hughes.
We, as disc jockeys, were the youngest people in broadcasting in the UK at that time. This is the mid-1960s I'm talking about. We were broadcasting to listeners who were our age and playing the music they wanted to hear. We brought a totally different sound to radio, and for the first time we had pop music night and day. And here we are, 50-plus years later, and I believe Radio Caroline was arguably the first reality show. Listeners could tune in to find out what we were doing on board the ship, what we'd had for lunch, how we coped in a Force 8 gale, and famous visitors coming to the ship. That is something we cannot create today. I believe the enthusiasm we had for the music we were playing made listeners enjoy the music that much more. Pirate radio was bold, and it was boisterous. Broadcasting had changed forever. Being on a ship in the North Sea, the weather was changeable. One day sunny, with calm seas, and on other occasions we had Force 8 gales where the ship tossed and turned, pitched and rolled. But during calm weather we were often visited by listeners in small craft who came out to see us and asked for record requests to be played. No one, in those days, was allowed on board. We would sign autograph books, the visitors would have cameras, take pictures of us chatting to them over the side of the ship. Back in the studio during rough weather, it was difficult to control a programme. The records would jump off the turntable when a heavy wave would hit the ship. So when a storm was brewing, we used to place heavy coins on the stylus of the turntable. This did no good whatsoever to the stylus, but it did keep the record playing. Fortunately, months later, along came cartridge machines, so we could pre-record music onto those tapes.
Thank you very much indeed, Squire. Certainly does. And don't forget, if anybody happens to be listening upstairs, if you don't send that tinder away from here very, very shortly, I will not be able to play any more gramophone records, or will I, because I keep on jumping off the turntable. Don't say, Elvis, try and sing to us, please.
All that I am.
Well, I needed it first time.
Forever home.
Well, that does say a lot for the stability of the equipment here.
There were normally about 7 radio voices on the ship, each presenting 3-hour programmes with music, chosen by the DJs and taking turns to be newsreaders. In the early 1960s, the British music industry was just starting to shine, and with the advent of pirate radio, it gave many new artists a very important outlet. There's no doubt that many pop stars owe their recording careers to pirate radio stations. Tom Jones was one.
This is Tom Jones wishing Radio Caroline a happy birthday and a swinging future. That is 65, 66, and I hope 67 and 68, 69. I think it's a wonderful programme. I would like to thank them very much for plugging my record.
Towards the end of 1964, we learned of the Tamla Motown sound coming out of the United States of America from Detroit, and we gave much exposure to groups like the Supremes, the Four Tops, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Junior Walker and the All-Stars, Martha and the Vandellas.
But in my lonely room,
We worked 2 weeks on the ship and then had a week's leave. And when we came ashore at Harwich for our 7 days on land, having cleared customs and immigration, we'd be met by dozens of young radio listeners. Some would be school children, others young housewives. And they would want to take photographs, ask us to sign autograph books, request records to be played on our return to the ship. And a number of fans would actually follow us on the train and climb aboard and get off at the next station, Manningtree or Colchester. We in turn gave them pop records that had been sent to us by the music industry. At the time, we took it all in our stride, never believing that we were as famous as some of the recording artists whose records we played. It was during this period of time, 1964 to 1967, that was classed as the age of the disc jockey. Most of us were asked to compare pop shows. I still retain some letters that were sent to me 50 years ago. They are listeners who tune into my BBC programme nowadays. They were original Radio Caroline listeners. Now that is what I call loyalty.
Presenting Caroline Radio News.
Broadcasting, the Isle of Man has won a temporary reprieve in the battle against the British government over the application of the Marine Offences Bill to the Isle of Man.
It was during my time on Caroline that I decided to start making notes of events that were happening at the time. I was very aware that the government would eventually close us down. These notes were eventually turned into a book that was originally going to be called A Life on the Medium Wave. However, the government stopped the publishers releasing the book as it would contravene the Marine Etc. Broadcasting Act of Parliament of 1967. I had to wait 25 years before the book was allowed to be published, by which time Medium Wave was more or less a thing of the past, so I renamed the book Pop Went the Pirates. Accommodation was very cramped aboard the ship. I'm talking about the Mi Amigo. We had 2 bunks in each cabin. I shared with an Australian DJ, Brian Vaughan, who I'm still in touch with to this very day. He presented the breakfast show and would get up about 5 o'clock in the morning, whereas I would get up, shower, have breakfast about 7:30 and go on air at 9 o'clock in the morning doing a 3-hour show. All the English-speaking presenters and engineers had meals at one time, the Dutch crew in the same mess room, but at a different time. We had a 12-inch television set that picked up BBC and Anglia TV. As regards the meals on board, breakfast, for example, we would enjoy cereals, followed by a cooked meal of sausage, egg, and also toast and marmalade. None of us on board the Mi Amigo starved. The food was delivered to the ship by a small tender that brought provisions from Holland. The chef on board would then prepare the food for the British personnel and a separate breakfast for the Dutch crew. I will always remember to my dying day that nutmeg was served with every dish, even on cornflakes.
Caroline, the sound of the nation.
Caroline, the sound of the land. Caroline, the sound of the nation.
During the afternoon, I would spend a few hours in the record library that was once called the stateroom on the ship. We had about 5,000 records on board, all vinyl. I'd taken a portable typewriter on board, so spent much time replying to listeners' letters, also planning the music to play in my show for the following morning. We didn't actually have scripts, I just prepared a music running order. And with our first Christmas broadcast from Radio Caroline, we wanted to transmit the Queen's speech on Christmas Day. The Caroline press officer in London wrote to the Director General of the BBC to ask permission if Caroline could broadcast the speech. And a reply was sent to Caroline House to ask if they were a legitimate government-approved radio station. Buckingham Palace said that the Queen's speech was available to any broadcaster, but the BBC had to make the final decision. So why would a rebellious radio station out at sea that played pop music all day want to broadcast the Queen's speech? Yes, I guess we were rebellious in the way we went about broadcasting the pop music that we played. We rebelled against the government, but we had the greatest respect for Her Majesty the Queen and the royal family. And it was our intention to prove to the government that we wanted to be treated as a legitimate radio station. We wanted respect and recognition. both the BBC and the government refused to play ball. No change there, then. During my time on Radio Caroline South, I was sent a reel-to-reel tape from Derek Taylor. He was working with the Beatles in their publicity department, and he was in the United States of America and had visited a recording studio to listen to an audition of a new group recording a couple of Bob Dylan songs. He sent me a copy of one of those tracks. I fell in love with it and played it on air. This tape was called Mr. Tambourine Man, and the group were called The Birds. I played it every day on my programme whilst I was there during that fortnight. It had not been released by any record company at that time. It was purely an audition tape. Caroline House were besieged with phone calls from listeners wanting to know where they could buy the record. Eventually, it was released by CBS Records in this country. I was very flattered when I was asked by them to present the CBS record show on Luxembourg. So I had to leave Caroline at the end of 1965. My theme tune became Mr. Tambourine Man, but an instrumental version played by the Golden Gate Strings, and I still use that every time I broadcast these days. If ever I meet Bob Dylan, I hope he'll appreciate that the royalties he's received via me playing Mr. Tambourine Man. Although I visited Luxembourg to have a look at the studios and meet the DJs, the shows that I presented for CBS were recorded in Hertford Street, London, 38 Hertford Street, in fact, to be precise. I do walk past that building from time to time.
This is Radio Luxembourg, your station of the stars, broadcasting on 208 metres medium wave.
As a schoolboy, I used to listen to Radio Luxembourg under the bedclothes, as did so many people, so I was quite flattered when asked to present a weekly show. Popular records at that time, they were Tony Bennett, I Left My Heart in San Francisco, Positively Fourth Street, Bob Dylan, Secondhand Rose, Barbara Streisand, just to name a few. Working for Radio Luxembourg, we were well paid. A guinea a minute. That was against Caroline's £20 a week. I did not enjoy presenting the show. You simply went into the studio, read a couple of lines, someone in the control room would play a record, you would back announce it, and then play the next record. To be honest, I missed talking to the audience that you could do on the Pirates. You know, the audience were your family. I believe the listening figures to Radio Luxembourg would have suffered once the Pirates became established. The Pirate stations could be heard clearly night and day in the UK, whereas Luxembourg's signal did fade in and fade out most evenings. And Luxembourg only broadcast at night.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Radio Luxembourg, your station of the stars, broadcasting on 208 metres in the medium wave band, commencing its Sunday evening transmission, which continues until 2 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Fortunately, in 1966, I was invited by a colleague, Richard Swainson, to meet the management of Radio London that had its office just around the corner from Radio Luxembourg. Radio London were based in Curzon Street in Mayfair, and I was offered a job as a presenter. This really excited me because Radio London had station identification jingles and, in my mind, was the most professional of the offshore stations. I did join them in the summer of 1966. A great staff of management in London, superb DJs and engineers on board, first-class Dutch captain and crew.
Wonderful Big L.
The motor vessel Galaxy was a former United States minesweeper that had seen action in the Far East during World War II and was much larger and better serviced than, should we say, the Mi Amigo. And we had single cabins. The Galaxy weighed in at 780 tons. The Mi Amigo was less than half that weight. Programme-wise, Big L Radio London adopted a top 40 format, and they were the first pirate station to introduce news bulletins into their programs each hour. Radio Caroline did follow on a few weeks later. I was very upset when the government decided to close us down. That was on the 14th of August, 1967.
As one listener put it, the world will get by without Big L, but I'm not sure that it will be a better place.
Wonderful Big L, wonderful radio, London.
All the stations that operated offshore gave a superb service, so much so that we're still talking about them now, more than 50 years later. And that must prove something.
Well, there they go, the cymbals. I don't want to let them clash anymore. And Canadian Sunset, an old tune that's been done up 1966 type style. I had a script here to read somewhere. I've come... Here we go then, cue music.
Radio London, disc of the week.
Oh, careful, I don't press the wrong what's it. And what is going on, Skews?
Music!
Thank you. The Nautilus Club, South Pier Ballroom, low staff.
People tomorrow in London night. Did take notice, and the government decided to introduce a radio pop channel, and over 100 DJs were interviewed for possible jobs. In the end, only about a dozen of us were selected. I was particularly delighted to be one of them.
Music loving Keith, Skews on 247 Radio 1.
Right, OK, there we go, the letter from the box tops, and that's all for Saturday Club today. I'd like to say very many thanks indeed for all the telegrams and the cards, the good wishes that we've all received here at the BBC in London. We all appreciate it, and to all well listeners, we hope to be with you in the very, very near future. Saturday Club ends...
And I enjoyed a good career as a Radio 1 and Radio 2 presenter, then joining the BBC staff as an announcer in 1970. This was an interesting time as I presented the Sunday Breakfast Show on Radio 2 for 2 years. That was a mixture of vinyl records and in-house BBC orchestras. Also, did a two-hour midnight to 2 a.m. show called Night Ride.
BBC television is closing down. Radios 1 and 2 are continuing through until 2 o'clock in the morning with Keith Skews, driving Night Ride, starting at 1 minute past midnight. He'll be reviewing a new Ray Conniff LP, and Country Expression and Sons and Lovers are just two of the groups featured in the programme. Night Ride with Keith Skews on Radios 1 and 2.
We did not have any commercial records in that show. I'd play music from the Canadian Talent Library, BBC tapes of locally recorded music from in-house orchestras and guest singers, and BBC Coded Music Scheme records. The nearest we would get to playing commercial pop records would be music from a film soundtrack. As a staff announcer, I'd also present a breakfast show on the BBC World Service, Good Morning Africa, and later in the day a programme, Pop Session, which was music recorded in the BBC studios of various pop groups and singers.
If you're listening on 1500 metres long wave, there's a little bit of a compensation for you because we've got one of our handsomest men there reading the shipping forecast. Over to you, Keith Skews.
Thanks very much indeed, Robin. Good morning, gentlemen. The shipping forecast at 0030 on this Monday morning, January the 22nd. There are warnings of gales in Viking, Forties, Cromarty...
We were gainfully employed as BBC staff announcers. As well as reading the news on Radios 1 and 2, I was allowed to be the voiceover man for some BBC One television variety shows. That was really exciting, meeting well-known personalities and doing the voiceovers for the show. Names like Ronnie Corbett, Kenneth Williams, Bruce Forsyth. They were a series probably on air once a week for 13 weeks. However, radio was my first love. Apart from Saturday Club, I was allowed freedom to basically do what I liked. But Night Ride was also my downfall. Each week, I did an interview with an imaginary person. I would ask the questions, and the imaginary person would reply. These included a man who was always shouting. So I'd ask a question and said, "Welcome to the Night Ride programme, and what exactly do you do?" "I shout a lot," you know, and doing stupid things like that. A man who's persistently sneezing. A man who kept repeating himself, pardon? Kept repeating himself. They were humorous, but I wouldn't get away with it in today's radio world. And I came a cropper in 1972 when I did an imaginary interview with the speaking clock. I just took words out of the lady's mouth to fit my questions. A complaint went straight to the head of radio. I was not aware that the speaking clock lady was a Radio 2 listener.
Precisely.
Or perhaps she wasn't, but somebody told her about it, and she was not amused. And as a result, I was taken off the air to do a desk job. Did it teach me a lesson? It certainly did. As I was a member of staff, the BBC did retain my services, and I was appointed editor of the long-running Radio 1 series, The Story of Pop, working with producer Tim Blackmore, person I'd respected greatly, and production secretary Jane Lucas. The presenter of the series was Alan Fluff Freeman, another person whom I've admired as a professional radio presenter. He didn't actually say much in between the records on air, but my goodness, what a voice.
Greetings, everyone. This is Alan Freeman with the BBC Story of Pop.
The Story of Pop series commenced with songs from the early 1950s right up to the time of recording, which was in 1973. Really, the star of the show was the story itself and to be told by the people who made it all happen. It was a magic 12 months, helping with the series that took me to America, where I met some of my teenage idols. I did interview many, but my voice was actually cut out and Alan Freeman's inserted. The only person I was not allowed to interview was Elvis Presley, but I did see him in concert in Nashville, and I have him on an amateur film I was making at the time. My BBC days of the 1960s and 70s ended in 1974 when I was asked to be programme director of a brand new commercial radio station that was to go on air in October 1974.
Radio Hallam boasts that it presents its news 5 minutes sooner. Radio Hallam's news editor is Ian Rufus.
On Radio Hallam, you'll get the news fast. Whether it's a new government in Romania or a new council in Rotherham, you'll hear about it first on Radio Hallam.
Bruce Windham was a seasoned broadcaster on Radios 1 and 2. His wife, Gania, had connections with Trident Television that owned Yorkshire and Tyne Tees. And I was invited to an informal meeting with staff in London to see if I'd be interested in helping to set up a new commercial radio station in Yorkshire to be based in Sheffield. I met Bill McDonald, who would become managing director, and we went to Sheffield to meet the board of directors that was headed by the Lord Lieutenant of South Yorkshire, Gerard Young. The next job was to produce a lengthy document detailing our programme schedule, broadcasting hours, etc., etc. Tom Chalmers, who'd been controller of the BBC Light programme in his day, came on board to offer his expertise. And I have a feeling that Tom was the very first voice on the Light programme when it began broadcasting at the end of the Second World War.
Good morning, everyone. This is the BBC Light programme on wavelengths of 1,500 and 261 metres.
This document had to be submitted to the IBA, the Independent Broadcasting Authority, based in London, who were issuing contracts to various consortiums across the country. We did have competition in Sheffield. Michael Parkinson was heading a consortium hoping for the licence. Both parties were invited to London to be interviewed by the IBA. We were the successful group, and the on-air date was set for the 1st of October, 1974. It was my job to recruit broadcasters, and I chose a handful of colleagues from the BBC in London, Roger Moffat, Peter Donaldson, Johnny Moran, and Bill Crozier. Colin Slade joined us from BBC Radio Kent, and I complimented them with local voices. This was actually a dream come true. I'd always wanted to run a commercial radio station as a programme director. It was hard work, but we achieved a great deal of recognition from both the IBA and the general public.
We're saying hello to Mrs. Janet Horden of 17 Cavendish Avenue, Loxley, which is near Sheffield. It was her first wedding anniversary 2 weeks ago, but Radio Hallam wasn't on the air then. So we say belated wedding anniversary and lots of love to you from your husband, John, and any record will do. All right. Well, greetings to Anne Garlick. That's a pretty hot
We were
name.
Also competing against a local BBC station that was very professional, Radio Sheffield. We had a strong news and sports team, features unit and music department, and we gave listeners a blend of entertainment, information and companionship. The emphasis really was on personality radio. We did well for listeners. We had more than any other station in the area at that time, except for one national station. Having said that, we got off to a rather embarrassing opening. Johnny Moran was presenting the breakfast show, and he was playing the record by Kiki D, I've Got the Music in Me.
Well, it seems these little things are sent to try us slightly on the very first morning of a new radio station, but what we would like to say most certainly is that, above all, Radio Hallam is a nice friend to have.
Our music format during the daytime was based on the playlist of 100 records, the top 40 singles reflected from local sales, 40 selected albums and 20 new releases. This playlist would change every week, not like some of today's radio stations that keep the same format for months and months. We would also update the jingles every year, and we even had our own Hallam song.
Whether you live in Sheffield or on the Yorkshire moors, you can be sure that we are yours anytime.
And if you live in Rotherham...
Beverly Chubb, who was Hallam's music producer, made sure we all listened to the new records that were released each week. She had joined us from Radio Luxembourg. The week before we went on air, the BBC kindly arranged a radio week in Sheffield. What a coincidence! BBC National Radio was here for 1 week, but Radio Hallam was here to stay.
All because you're tuned to Radio Hallam!
If I had to single out the most listened-to programme, it would be the Roger Moffat Show in the morning. He would have a go at Hallam management, the local city council, bus and train services. No one was safe from his outrageous attacks on people in authority. When Elvis Presley died, Roger came on air announcing the death of Elvis in 1975, and he hoped that Elvis would be stuffed and placed in the Radio Hallam reception. The newspapers had a field day. Roger liked to drink, and very often that took the better of him. Eventually, I had to give him a warning about mixing alcohol with presenting a radio show. The two don't work together. Well, not if you have too much alcohol. It was about this time I decided to try and record him talking about his life and times. Every week, I would pre-record him in a studio in an evening for 5 or 10 minutes.
I was in Aylesbury at my home, and the telephone rang, and the operator said, Key Skews is calling from London. Will you accept the charge? And I thought I might as well. So he rang, you see, and I said, Hello, Keith. And he said, how about lunch? I'd like you to meet Johnny Moran and Bill Crozier. How about lunch? He said, I'll meet you outside Claridge's.
After about 2 months, he was becoming rather suspicious of why I was doing this. And he suddenly shouted out, You're doing my obituary, aren't you? I said, No, Roger, you are doing your own obituary. I did turn this into a 2-hour documentary that was broadcast on the day of his death.
At 9.15 this morning, we flew over the Hackenthorpe area of Sheffield and scattered part of Roger's ashes over the fields towards Beighton. At a similar time, Sheffield funeral director Richard Heath, of John Heath & Sons, was leaving the city to carry out the second part of Roger's wishes.
Liaising with the bureaucratic IBA in the early days was more difficult than I had anticipated. They wanted to see our programme schedules, to include everything from religious output to live music from local musicians. 3% of our net advertising revenue had to be kept aside for the employment of musicians. The idea of running Hallam like an offshore radio station was soon thrown out of the window. There was a regional office of the IBA in Leeds, and they monitored us regularly and indeed paid us visits. I remember one of the IBA bosses writing to me as programme director saying that Radio Hallam's professional management has been the cause of some headaches.
Keith Skews.
We had an annual charity appeal called Money Mountain and donated many thousands of pounds over the years to local charities, including buying new equipment for the NHS hospitals in the county. One of our newsreaders, Ralph Bernard, came to me with an idea of doing a documentary series called Dying for a Drink, a programme about tackling alcoholism. We had not ventured down that path before on air. I talked it over with my fellow directors and we decided to ask Ralph to go ahead. The programme was eventually shared across 19 independent local radio stations. That was unique at the time because all the stations were doing local programming and had not planned shared programming.
3,000 years ago, in the rich, powerful and hot lands of ancient Egypt, people were probably getting drunk. 13 centuries before the birth of Christ, the ancient Egyptians were drinking a superior quality wine brought to them by...
We at Radio Hallam received no money from national or local government or public authority. The only income was from advertising, and we did have a strong sales team and administration staff. We had numerous outside broadcasts. We relied heavily on music, commercial records and local music. Record companies were invaluable and provided the station with new records and an excellent back catalogue of vinyl long-playing albums. They helped us with live appearances of singers and groups. Local news is vitally important to a local station, as is sport.
Something else which plays a very large part in the life of the South Yorkshire man and woman is sport. Here's Stuart Linnell, our sports editor, to tell you the score.
In South Yorkshire and the North Midlands, sport is big, and here on Radio Hallam, we treat it in a big way.
Many of our journalists went to bigger and better appointments later in their careers. Names that spring to mind immediately are Ian Rufus, who was our news editor, Jim Greensmith, Ralph Bernard, Roger Brooks, Stuart Linnell, Martin Kellner, Jonathan Kramer, David Roby and Dean Pepple. All ended up in senior post with either commercial radio or BBC radio after they'd departed from Hallam. I spent some of my happiest years at Radio Hallam from 1974 to 1990, but my time with them came to a sudden end. For many years, I'd been an RAF squadron leader reservist, having served in many parts of the world, including Australia, Gibraltar, Cyprus, the United States of America, and the Falklands. I was activated for Gulf War I and sent out to Dhahran in Saudi Arabia as a public relations officer for media operations, basically looking after journalists and feature writers, TV and radio reporters. We had a squadron of RAF Tornadoes that went on bombing raids into Iraq. All this came about because Saddam Hussein decided to order his army to invade Kuwait on the 2nd of August 1990.
Our objectives are clear. Saddam Hussein's forces will leave Kuwait. The legitimate government of Kuwait will be restored to its rightful place.
The Americans launched Operation Desert Storm, and we came on board with them by sending troops out to Saudi Arabia. There was naval and aerial bombardment, followed by a ground assault on the 24th of February. It was a decisive victory for the coalition. I returned to Sheffield to rejoin what had become Yorkshire Radio Network, taking in Classic Gold, where I worked for a time, Pennine Radio and Viking Radio. To say I was gobsmacked would be an understatement when I arrived at the reception desk to be told I was no longer wanted, as the radio station had been taken over by Metro Radio from Newcastle. As a director on the Radio Hallam board, I'd invested all my spare money into buying shares in the company. Learning that my future was no longer with Radio Hallam, I decided to sell every share. I was so upset at my treatment. With the money from those shares, I bought a property on the Costa del Sol. I'd worked with Hallam and Yorkshire Radio Network for 17 years. The downside was, for the first time in my life, I was without a job. And my personal life was also in shreds, as my then lady friend had found another man whom she later married. I contacted the Ministry of Defence to say that I'd lost my job whilst on active service and, as I was commissioned, they suggested I could carry on my time with the Royal Air Force. Within weeks, I was back in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia. I stayed there for 2 months and then returned to the United Kingdom and was posted to RAF Marham in Norfolk to join the public relations team who were preparing for the RAF's 75th anniversary. That was to be held on the 1st of April, 1993.
Britain's Queen Elizabeth and other members of the royal family turned out to watch a flypast of RAF planes marking the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. Wartime Spitfires...
A few days later, I received a phone call from Radio Norfolk, who asked me if I'd like to present a radio show on a forthcoming bank holiday. The RAF said they'd no objections, providing I was not being paid. This was BBC local radio. No chance there. More shows were offered to me, and eventually I was asked if I'd like to join the BBC on a more permanent basis. I think I said to the BBC's head of region, a gentleman called Arnold Miller, "I'll bite your hand off." This was a weekly nighttime show, 5 nights a week. I hung up my RAF uniform in 1994, it's still in the wardrobe, and have been working for BBC Regional Radio out of Norfolk ever since, and covering all stations in the east, as well as taking in Lincolnshire.
Cardboard Shoes, Keith Skews. It's BBC Radio for the Eastern Counties.
After a number of years, the BBC reduced my airtime to just 1 day a week. Well, I'd reached retirement age, so accepted that a younger presenter would take over. Having said that, the BBC has retained me for a 3-hour show each Sunday evening. So I've been a very lucky person. I was at the start of offshore radio, BBC Radio 1, and independent local radio. And during those years, we've seen many changes. For youngsters who want to enter the broadcasting world, there are now many more openings. Radio is now available on more platforms than ever before. As well as national stations, we have BBC regional and local stations. Commercial radio that tends to be more regional these days. In addition, there's digital audio broadcasting, community radio, hospital radio, student radio, not forgetting internet radio. You can now even hear radio stations via your Freeview, Sky and Virgin television channels. None of us are getting any younger, and it's sad to see so many of our original lineup of Radio 1 DJs have fallen off their perches in recent times. It's strange that the first record I played when I joined the late-night Eastern Counties BBC team was Take That, with their hit record Back for Good. I'm over the moon in being allowed to still broadcast. For me, it is a hobby. Being single and not enjoying family life, presenting a radio program makes up for that. The listeners are my wider family, and they make me feel wanted. Looking back, I've enjoyed a most interesting and varied career. Yes, it's had its ups, it's had its downs during my 57 years behind a microphone, but the good times outweigh any bad times. One of my most treasured memories is meeting and chatting with Her Majesty the Queen when she presented me with an MBE at Buckingham Palace in March 2004. On occasions, I'd broadcast in her presence, but never actually spoken to her in person or pressed the flesh. On a personal note, I'm sad that I never settled down and married. Why was this? I have to admit, I was selfish, always putting my job first. At this time in life, I have to make the difficult decision now what to do with my vast record collection, all the archive recordings I've collected over 57 years, my scrapbooks, lots of films that I made in different countries, my MBE, coat of arms, Freedom of the City of London, and household memorabilia. I'm fully aware that the Grim Reaper is lurking locally, and none of us will ever know when he decides to pounce. People often ask me, how would you like to be remembered? I don't like answering that question. Being remembered isn't the most important thing anyway. It's what you do when you're here on Earth that is important. But if I was really pressed for an answer, I'd like to be remembered as someone that helped bring happiness and fun to others.